Working Cows Podcast, Episode 76.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. This is Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. And I'm really excited about this episode with Charlie Arnott. But before we get into that, I do want to say, please remember to hit up workingcows.net/vote and vote for the Working Cows Podcast in the My Roadcast competition for the People's Choice Award. I was confused earlier when I said vote every day. It is just a one-time deal. So just go there and vote once and then share it out through text message and social media if you know people who would be interested in voting. Now, on to our episode for today. We've got Charlie Arnott, who is a grazier in Australia, and he's doing some really interesting things there, specifically something that piqued my interest from his great Facebook and YouTube page, which will be linked in the show notes page at workingcows.net/76, were some of the things centering around biodynamic agriculture. And so I invited Charlie on to talk to us about biodynamic agriculture and how that plays into some of the awards that they have won there in Australia for the different things that they are doing, raising and marketing grass-fed beef. So, Charlie, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Clay, wonderful to be here, very humbled to be asked to be on the show.
The first question I want to ask you is, what does it mean for you to put your cows to work for you on your operation?
Clay, I think that what's important as a grazier is to consider themselves as a partner with their animals, with their livestock. You know, that we as stewards of the landscape are not just looking after the landscape, but utilizing those animals for as a tool. And you know, all tools need to be looked after. So you know, we consider our cattle and our sheep, and we've also got pigs as well. And we use them all strategically in our landscape to achieve particular outcomes. But, you know, it's not all one-way traffic. We have to look after them because they're doing such a wonderful job of looking after our landscape. So, you know, they are working for us, but at the end of the day, we're really working for them as well. What they give is so much. They literally give their lives to us, and throughout their life they're helping us manage that pasture. You know, they're essentially and indirectly pumping carbon into the ground, which is what we want to do to create more organic matter and grow more grass, retain more moisture, and have much more resilient and not just resilient but actually progressive businesses. So, you know, they're really important, and we love our cattle. However, I guess that brings me to a point that one thing that really changed in my mind and changed my whole business outlook and outcome was the minute that I actually started loving my grass more than my cattle. So whilst we love our cattle, we have to love our grass more, because if we do that, we actually prioritize the grass over the cattle, which means we sell our cattle when we have to, and we look after our grass every day of the year. So, you know, that for me was a real turning point in I guess our attitude and our management philosophy.
Very good. Yeah, absolutely. All of that. We're all about that here on the Working Cows Podcast. And I would like to talk to you today about one of the tools that you are using to love your grass more than your cattle, if I understand the tool correctly. That's why I've invited you on here, to help me understand the tool of biodynamics. So could you just give us a brief primer or introduction to the ideas of biodynamics?
Clay, in 1924, Rudolf Steiner did a series of lectures in Austria or Germany or on the border there somewhere, I think it was, to a group of farmers, and he'd been asked to do the lectures about agriculture and crop and livestock production, because those German farmers had found that with the increased use of the NPK type of inputs in their farming, that their yields were being reduced, the quality was reduced, and they were really struggling with how to continue farming, essentially, in this new sort of heading into a sort of industrial type of farming. So he basically, and I don't totally understand how he did it. He was an intuitive, very clever man. There's whole bookstores dedicated to his work. However, he spoke about biodynamics as a way to revitalize soil, and it wasn't just a physical thing. It's a philosophical thing. You know, there's some sort of cosmic angles to it. However, the basic science behind it is we're using cow manure. We're using natural substances. We're composting them essentially in different ways to produce a range of inputs, and they are inputs. However, you know, those inputs are used to improve soil, improve fertility, to create better, to enhance microbes in the soil. So it's definitely an input. It takes not too much effort, but it's a lovely ritual we find in our business. And the wonderful thing was we're actually using products that are, we're producing ourselves. Some of the herbs that we compost, that we use, we grow ourselves. The cow manure we collect from our paddock. The quartz rock that we use to make one of the preparations we find in our paddock, as is the basalt. And the eggshells come from our chickens. So it's a lovely way to, again, partner with nature, using natural resources, you know, reasonably closed loops of the system. And there's a number of preparations that we make. We have to buy some because we can't make all of them. And we use them throughout the year to enhance pasture, enhance soil, and the health of the livestock.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. You said you're collecting the manure from the paddock. What does that look like? How does that process work?
Well, we simply collect it from, generally we use lactating cow manure. Some reasonably prescriptive biodynamic practitioners say it has to be a dairy cow manure. We've got beef cattle, but they're lactating, so to me it's the same sort of stuff. It's only through human intervention that we've actually bred a line of dairy cattle as opposed to beef cattle. They're doing the same thing. And we use lactating cow manure over normal cow manure because we're looking for the calcium, because this particular process we use in this, when we collect the manure, enhances calcium processes in the soil. So there's actually more calcium in the manure of a lactating cow than it's in its milk. So we simply collect that in the paddock, and we use that in two ways. One is in a preparation called the cow manure concentrate, and that's actually a big pit. It's about a wheelbarrow full of cow manure, fresh, reasonably sloppy, I guess, and moist. And in that wheelbarrow full or cement mixer full, we throw a couple of handfuls of eggshell, we throw a couple of handfuls of basalt, and we stir that in a cement mixer for 1 hour. And then we put that in the ground, and it's basically, and then it composts over 3 or 4 month period. Before we set it to compost over that period, once we put it in the ground, we put 6 different compost preparations, they're called, into that cow manure, that fresh cow manure pit. And that these 6 compost preparations are essentially, we could just leave that manure in the ground and it's going to compost beautifully. And it's going to make amazing, basically composted cow manure that we can then dilute and spread on pasture. It's like a manure tea. But what we're doing by putting the compost preparations in, and there's 6 of them, is we're putting some organisational structure into that compost. So the six herbs that are used in these preparations are all made using vessels, like organs of animals. One's using a skull, one's using the mesentery of a cow, the small intestine, the bladder of a steer, the bladder of a stag, and so on. So just like our bodies have organs that serve different functions in our body, by using these herbs that have been created in the organs of animals and then putting them into the compost heap, we're actually putting an organizing structure in there. So that actually functions more like an entity or a body almost. So the end result of that is we've got a supercharged compost. We've got compost that has some structure. We've got compost that has some, you know, dare I say, intelligence, basically. And it actually works, you know, it's a much more active manure. And so it's in the ground for a few months. We take that out. We then use that at a dilution of 150 grams a hectare by stirring that in water for an hour. And then we put that on our pasture at least twice a year in the autumn and spring. Then the other one, another one we use of cow manure is 500. It's basically a soil activator, and it focuses on the calcium activity of the soil, and it's great for seed germination and root development and the growth of the plant. So there's those two main preparations we use this cow manure, and we've got heaps of it, you know. So and one of the wonderful things is about people starting in biodynamics is, you know, they don't have to have cows to use this stuff. You know, their neighbour has or someone down the road. And I always say, look, you know, take them a case of a beer, a box of beer, and say, you know, can I go and collect a wheelbarrow of your cow manure? Here's a box of beer. We're all buddies, and I'll give you some of the stuff we're making. And half the time they probably won't know what the hell they're doing with their manure. The neighbour, and it doesn't really matter. But, you know, I guess as I said, one of the wonderful things about biodynamics is it creates ritual within a business, and that is really easily slipped into the current operation. You know, you don't have to go and buy a heap of crazy gear, spend a heap of money, change your whole management structure or your the way you do things in your operation. Just slips in really easily. So, yeah, look, it's wonderful. I love it.
So basically the collection process of the manure is a shovel and a wheelbarrow? Is that my understanding?
That's it. Yeah, a shovel, a couple of small buckets and a big bucket on the back of a truck, a lorry, a little buggy, whatever you got. And it's another opportunity to get out in the paddock and literally get your hands dirty. You know, that stuff's good for your hands. We have dung beetles that operate for most of the year, you know, and it's another opportunity to see the lovely work that those guys are doing, their unpaid staff. You know, they're putting that manure in the ground. We're actually taking away their manure. So there's a bit of give and take there. And the interesting thing is, you know, you leave that manure in the middle of summer, and happened the other day, you leave that manure in that wheelbarrow or in that cement mixer for, you know, longer than you should. And it's just full of dung beetles, and it's quite sad seeing the little critters, you know, turning around that wheelbarrow. But anyway, they're doing their job, and so are we. So, yeah, it's an easy process. We usually do it in the morning when the cattle have just got up and starting their day. That's in the fields. But also, you know, if we're putting them through the yards and there's a concentration of them, it's an easy way to collect it then too.
I can't tell you how much I love this for a lot of reasons. One of them is that Steve Kenyon is, we'll say, a regenerative grazer in Canada. And he says that his best employees are his underground employees, the soil microbes and the dung beetles and those kinds of guys, because they work from birth till death. They don't, and all they work for is room and board, and you don't have to pay them a salary. You don't have to give them health insurance or pay for their retirement, anything like that. So I just love it because this stuff works wherever it's tried. You know, it works everywhere it's been tried, and there in Australia and Steve Kenyon in Canada couldn't be more conclusive proof of the reality that this stuff works wherever it's tried. So one quick note, as we translate from the imperial system to what something an American would understand, I work in grams every day with my coffee preparation process because I'm a huge coffee snob and nerd after owning a coffee shop for 10 years. 150 grams is about 3 ounces, and a hectare is about 2.5 acres. So we're talking three ounces to 2.5 acres when you go to mix this up. So it doesn't take a terrible lot of of manure, I'm guessing, to cover a paddock.
Not at all. So one pit, one cow manure concentrate pit, you know, wheelbarrow full or cement mixer full, will do about 300 hectares. So that's one application. And as I said, we try and do it twice a year. So spring and autumn is the best time because it's not too extreme. And when I talk about extremes, I know extremes, you guys there have an extreme winter. We don't quite get as cold as you. Our summers probably do get a little hotter than you. But autumn and spring, or your fall and now spring, are the best times. The soil moisture is usually, you know, it's enough. The activity in the soil is not too cold, not too hot. And also the application is an aerial application in that we don't inject it into the ground. I mean, we just use very simple spray gear, one nozzle. We don't have fancy spray rigs. I used to be in cropping. I used to use a lot of chemical. I used to have a lot of gear. But now I've got a fire pump. Essentially, we have bushfires here every summer. So we have basic gear, a tank, a pump, and we just use that. And you can buy simple nozzles, and what you want is a large droplet size. We don't need fine aerial spraying for these particular preparations. You can even get those hose nozzles that you have in the garden and stick that on your gear. And you just want it to go up and down, fall on the ground. And when we do spray, we do it in the afternoons. So the earth has many cycles involved in the earth, of course, but one is a daily one. It's a breathing out in the morning and sort of during the day, and a breathing back in the evening and the night time. And so what we do is after about 3 o'clock in the afternoon is when we do the spraying of the soil preparations, because there are a few atmospheric preparations in biodynamics, but the soil ones you do in the afternoon, and that's when you want the soil. And that there's literally a sort of a downward floating of the air, you know, as the earth breathes back in. So you can see the droplets need to land on the ground. We also do it, and this is reasonably important, do it after the cattle have been through the paddocks. So you want them to have eaten that grass, eaten that pasture, opened up the cover on the ground there, so that the droplets land, if not on soil, onto grass that is about to start growing again after it's grazed. And as we do, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do over there, you know, we rest our pastures for a long period of time. So it's getting a really, you know, could be 3, could be 5 months of rest. So big droplet size on the ground after the cattle have been through gives it all that time to actually do its work. Yeah, and as I said, it's really simple. And we just do it, you know, we do it when we're moving cattle. We've got a little four-wheel bike and a little tank that sits on that. And we can just mix up a batch of this stuff. Put it on the tank, and as we're literally moving the cattle out of the paddock and into the next one, we've just got the spray nozzle on the back going. It's only 100 litres, and we're just meandering all over the paddock. This stuff's not precision ag. You know, you don't have to do tram tracks and so on. You know, as Hamish Mackay, our wonderful biodynamic educator, says, and I emulate that, you know, 80% of something's better than 100% of nothing. And so even getting, you know, half of the paddock, half the field done, a crisscross as you're moving the cattle out is better than nothing, and it's going to have an effect, because you know biodynamics is not just about a physical thing landing on the ground. It's about, you know, as I said, there's some cosmic sort of stuff going on there. I don't even fully understand it, but it's an energetic thing. It's homeopathic almost, and it's as they say in Australia, it's a vibe. And so even just being in the paddock with this kind of stuff. And it's a lovely thing, you know, when I go spraying, I, you know, when we're doing it with a truck, with a tank, you know, the radio's off, the windows are down, I'm really thinking about what I'm doing. I'm enjoying being there in nature. I'm thinking about those unpaid staff, the dung beetles, the biota in the soil. I'm thinking about the cattle, what they've done for me and what they're doing to the pasture and what this preparation's doing when it's landing on the ground. So it's a lovely connection with our landscape when we go out there and spray. And as I said, it's an easy thing to do as well.
That's so cool. So we need to talk some more about the how-to. One of the things, and we'll transition to that by just something I picked up from one of your videos, that you like to talk about the what, the why, and the how are the three things that you like to talk about. So we've covered a little bit of the what we're talking about. We're going to keep working on that. And we've talked a little bit of the why, but the how is one of the things. So what is the, where would you go to find a recipe? Is that kind of what you would call this, that you're working with recipes when you're developing these biodynamic applications?
Great question, Clay. So there are recipes, and there's plenty of books about biodynamics and what preparations to use and when. There's a great one by Peter Proctor called Grasp the Nettle. Grasp the Nettle, you'll probably find it online and so on. It gives a really good rundown on a bit of background of biodynamics, and also the operational, the how-to, you know, what the preparations do and when to use them. There's actually plenty of stuff online about that. Some is more country-specific, as in, you know, some European stuff. But I guess whilst there are recipes and there are some degree of prescription to using biodynamics, my philosophy around it, and so as is Hamish Mackay's, is that it's got to be adapted, not adopted. You know, it's about, and that can be site specific, and also could be country specific. So Steiner, you know, he put this stuff together in Europe, and they had stag bladders probably all over the place. You know, they had access to things. They were using herbs that were of European origin. You know, Australia is very different to Europe. People are starting to use kangaroo bladders, for instance. You know, some people are using different manures to experiment with. And And I think that's a good thing. You know, some, and it's fine, some vitamin practitioners are very prescriptive and they say that if it's not done exactly the way Steiner said, then we shouldn't be doing it. However, Steiner was a big fan of adaption. You know, he said experiment. There were some lectures he was going to give about how to experiment and how to sort of some variations on what he'd already said, but he never got to the, he never got to give those lectures. So it's all about, you know, making it yours, owning the process, using your own resources, using the recipes and the formulas as a guideline. So I would suggest using the recipes and do it not by the letter, but just do it to a point that you're comfortable then going, okay, this feels good now. You know, in Australia, then people might start using a kangaroo bladder or other organs of the body. If they understand why those particular organs are being used, then they can understand how you can then adapt to the resources we have. So, again, plenty of resources online as to the recipes. Some examples of the ways we have adapted this stuff is that in some schools of thought in biodynamics, you have to use a stirring machine to stir the liquid preparations for an hour. It's literally a big barrel. It stirs one way, creates a vortex, and then it stirs the other way. And there's this chaos and order and chaos and order for an hour. Now, we use a thing called a flow form, and you can Google this as well. It's basically a series of bowls that as the water flows through each bowl, and they sit on top of each other, and as the water flows from one bowl to the other, they create a figure eight within each bowl. It's a beautiful thing to watch and listen to, for one thing, but it actually is a really effective way to create these vortexes and this chaos and order as well. So we use a flow form. It's really effective, very simple to use. Just got a big tub. It's a, you know, 1,000 litres. I'm not sure how many gallons that is. That'd be
350
gallons,
something like that. There's 3.78 litres to the gallon. The only reason I know that is because it's been on every gallon of milk I've ever drank out of in my life.
Well, that's about right, because we have 200-litre drums here, and I always refer to them as 44-gallon drums, so that's about right. So we have a large tub. We have this flow form. It's only a series. It's three bowls. They're made out of fiberglass. We buy them from a fellow at Byron Bay here in Australia, and a submersible pump. It's very simple. However, we have a large area of land we need to cover, and not all of it you can get over with a vehicle and spray. So what we also do is we put the compost preparations in the cowpat manure and some of the other preparations into like big tea bags. You know, so we get a bit of shade cloth and we sew it together, probably a foot and a half by a foot and a half. We fill it up with, we half fill it with cow manure concentrate or the 500, and or even compost that we've made using the compost preparations. And that's another story, but you don't need much of this stuff. So we make these big tea bags and we actually put them in the troughs, in the water troughs where the cattle and sheep are. So whilst it's not getting stirred before it goes in, which would be ideal, it's literally a tea bag sitting in a trough, and as the water flows through, it's taking the fine particles of the cow manure concentrate into the water, and it's going through the animal. And it's being, and they're depositing it, you know, out the front and out the back and everywhere, all over the field, into places we can't get a vehicle to spray. So, you know, again, there are unpaid staff, and it's wonderful. You know, and I have no doubt at all that this going through their body is doing them some good. It's probably like a probiotic or a prebiotic or something. You know, it's biology. So, you know, that's a lovely thing too, and they don't mind. You know, we don't have problems with cattle, you know, not drinking the water because we put this stuff in there. And it's not like a big coffee brew, you know, concentration and it turns the water black or anything. This is a very subtle change. It's got a lovely, lovely earthy smell. So that's it. It's an example of how we've adapted the recipes. Yeah, and it works a treat.
Oh man, that's cool stuff. By the way, this will be workingcows.net/76. Show notes page for today, workingcows.net/76. If you want to check out what we're talking about today, you can head over there. We'll have some stuff up on the show notes page. I did find that book on Amazon, Grasp the Nettle by Peter Proctor. According to Amazon, there's one in stock, and you can get it for $25 right now. So we might do some more poking around. I did find another copy of it for $85. So we'll find some more copies of it and see what we can do. But we'll have a link to it on the show notes page so that you know what book to be looking for. So yeah, show notes page for today, workingcows.net/76. I do want to talk a little bit about your resource base. And as we transition to talking about your resource base, I would like to ask you, how much does soil temperature affect or play into the ability to compost in the soil when you are using these biodynamic preparations?
Yeah, the soil temperature is definitely a consideration. And as I said before, you know, it's the twice a year in the times of the year when the soil is not too hot, not too cold. And not too hot, not too cold is, you know, anywhere from sort of 15 to 20 degrees, I guess, you know, somewhere around there, or 25, you know, that's Celsius, of course. So, you know, you want it when the activity and the biology in the soil is able to actually utilize it and be enhanced or be influenced by what you've put on the soil. In a composting situation, that's a whole other conversation. Is, you know, we use a static compost pile sort of method. It's very basic. And when we made the compost, we spread it on paddocks and we use it, as I said, in these tea bag situations, in troughs. And so we get either sheep manure from underneath our shearing shed, or we get cow manure from the yards, or we get, and we're talking, you know, truckloads of this stuff, or there's a horse stud down the road, there's an organic chicken farm, you know, half an hour away. So we try and collect, you know, manure from anywhere we can, any animal manure. And then we buy some hay, or we've got some old hay of our own, and we make a compost. And we throw, you know, we might have a cow die, or a goose, or a pig, or something. It goes in the compost as well, because there's a wonderful amount of nutrition, you know, in those animals. So we don't lose that, and so that goes in the compost. And we're talking compost piles that are, you know, twice as high as a man, and, you know, quite a few wide. And they basically sit there, and they might sit there for a few months. My daughter calls them a cow sandwich, because if we're starting a new one, we put a layer of straw, we put the cow, the dead animal on that, we put a load of manure on top of that, some more straw, we do a few more layers, and we basically, you know, wrap up this cow in this beautiful, beautiful cow burger. So, a couple of months later, we might come along and mix it up again, and so on. So if you're getting a smell, you're losing nutrients, basically, so we've got to stop that. But so there's a temperature deviations in there. We don't monitor it, really. You don't want it too hot. I think 55, 60 degrees Celsius is too hot. You want to maintain it at about, I think, 45 or 50. However, as I said, we're reasonably lazy when it comes to composting and farming generally. So, you know, we just throw it in there, see what happens. It takes longer, but the end result's just amazing. It's golden, beautiful compost. So there's a bit about temperature and compost making, but back to the soil. Yeah, look, it's important because you're not wasting your time if you're doing it in summer. You're not wasting your time if you're doing it in winter, but you're just not being effective. So, and you want to do it when that soil biology is just pumping.
Yeah, so that's 25 degrees would be about 59 degrees Fahrenheit. So just another bit of translation there. Yeah. So can you tell me about your resource base? We've talked to David McLean. We've talked to David McLean before on the podcast from Resource Consulting Services there in Australia. That is right what that RCS stands for, I think. But anyways, yeah. So we talked to him before. He's up in the northwest, I think we talked about, right? Or northeast?
Northeast Yeppoon on the coast.
Yeah. But the ranches, the stations up there tend to be bigger and drier than they are in your neck of the woods. Is that accurate?
Look, they're generally, that's probably the easiest way to say it. They are larger. They're hundreds of thousands of acres and hectares. You know, we're 5,000 acres. And they have generally more extreme temperatures in the summer and longer periods of no rain, I'd say it's probably fair to say. Now, they have a lot of sort of wet season, which is over the summer, and a very dry season. So they've got to grow a lot of grass over the summer when it's rained, and then they've got to sit that basically a standing haystack in the paddock to get through the winter.
Yeah, absolutely. So could you tell me about your resource base then, what kind of inches of rainfall you're getting and some of those things, types of grass and some of those things?
Sure. So rainfall is, look, you know, what's an average? But our official average is sort of 25, 26 inches. No conversion there. it's funny, isn't it? That, you know, in some things we talk of imperial and some metric. So 25, 26 inches of rain. You know, traditionally, Burrawa, where we are, is one we call it a Mediterranean climate, where we would get more rain in winter. When it's probably less effective, to be honest, it's a bit too cold, and then a dry summer. However, if you look at the long-term average, it's basically 2 inches every month. But that's over, 100 or more years of data. So that's our rainfall. We've actually, at this point in time, last year, I should say, in 2018, we had less than half our average rainfall, which is not fun. However, there's plenty of places further west and north from us in New South Wales and Queensland that have had probably 10 to 15% of what they would normally get in their average year. They've been getting that for probably 5 to 7 years. So it's really pretty ordinary out there at the moment. And there, no amount of good management's really helping when you're 7 years into a drought. So we're really blessed and very grateful we're getting what we've got. We have a range of soils. We've got mainly basalt sort of soils. There's some light pipe clay sort of stuff we call down low. Not much topsoil. You know, I think, 200 and plus years ago when white men came to Australia, there's talk of, a foot of this beautiful, loamy, rich, spongy soil, across the whole country, So what we've done very successfully in the last, it took a few years, we've actually taken that topsoil off. So we're trying to nurture our topsoil back again. We've got 5,000 acres. We've got some country we used to crop. We used to be pretty keen croppers. Lots of chemical, lots of gear, lots of inputs. So the western half of our property, our ranch is arable, but now we've just let the pasture succeed in most of those areas, and we're just crazy as to the east. It's a bit more shaley and limey, lighter country we'd call it. We run a pretty tight operation now. We sold a lot of our gear. As I said, we used to be cropping. We used to burn a lot of diesel, and we had a clearing sale some years ago. We got rid of that. We've got a few, we've got one lorry, one truck that we cart stuff and stock around in, a couple of motorbikes, a couple of utes, pickups, I guess you call them. And we don't have too much gear because we just don't need it. We're not having to cart a heap of inputs around to put in the ground or put into our animals. So that's really it. We've got probably 250 breeders at the moment, cows and calves. We have had up to 600 some years ago, but we've just lightened the load given the current and the long-term sort of climate and lack of rain. We got back into sheep. We're out of sheep for many, many years, and we've got back into sheep, and we've got probably close to 1,000 breeders now, breeding ewes, and we basically produce a fat lamb with those. We sell those lambs into a couple of butcher shops into Sydney, and Sydney is 4 hours away. And we love that because we know that our products are being eaten by people who know where it's come from. They know, if not me personally, they understand at least where it's come from and how it's produced. We also sell some of our beef to those same butcher shops. And again, it's a lovely connection between, what we're doing in the country and what our customers are doing in the city. We've also got some pigs, which we sell generally locally, in a boxed up sort of a pork box, a couple of times a year. So, that's really our production system. We rely on grass, obviously, heavily. That's we don't feed grain. It's all grass fed. And so when you step back from the production system of animals through to the grass, which they're eating, well, how do you produce good grass? Well, it comes back to the soil. That's the most important element of all of this, really. Well, I shouldn't say the most important. I guess the most important element of getting back to the RCS and David McLean sort of philosophies is people matter most. And, you know, the people have got to be happy, and the people in the business and the families have to be, you know, what they're doing has to be aligned with their values and their vision. And if it's not, then that's where things come unstuck. And you could be the best, you know, you could be throwing biodynamics around till the cows come home and have wonderful pasture and wonderful infrastructure. But if you're not happy, that's like, what are you doing it for? You know, that's back to your statement, Clay, about why and how and what. You know, that's the why. Why are we doing this? Why are we even living on, you know, on our property, on our ranch? Well, we do because we love it, you know. And we love what we're doing. We love caring for the landscape. So, yeah, that's probably the number one principle for us. I'm sorry, I went rambling then. I was loving it. I was on a roll.
Good. I was loving it too. So, yeah, so you have, I've heard you talk about on some of your videos, great Facebook page, by the way, that'll be linked at the show notes page as well, workingcows.net/76. I've heard you talk there a couple of times about the transition, and you've talked today about transitioning away from tillage, away from farming, and you've talked about it as almost a spiritual awakening on some level. Could you talk a little bit about the process of that transition and how that all came to be and kind of what you were doing before and what you're doing now? You've talked about what you're doing now, but
yeah, sure. So in about 1997, I went away from after school and did things, went pearl diving up in the northern part of Australia and did some other crazy things and went to university, and I came home in 1997. And took over from Dad, I was working with Dad, my father and Michael, and we were doing things, as I say, conventionally. You know, we were using a lot of chemical, we were growing a lot of crops, we were doing a good job of it, but we're producing stuff, but we're probably doing a really good job of killing stuff too. You know, like that old way of that conventional farming, you know, side is the word that is on everything. It's death. You know, we were, as Charlie Massey said in his book Call of the Reed Warbler. You know, his grandson was driving to school one day or into town one day, and he said, "Dad, why do we have to kill so many things to produce things or grow things?" You know, so we were doing a great job of killing stuff and not working with nature, and there was a lot of, you know, there were some good things about it. We were, you know, winning crop competitions and feeling pretty good about things, but we weren't partnering with nature. So in 2004. I got to a point. I went to a one day seminar in town in Boorowa, and it was called Profiting from the Drought. And I thought, wow, this would be a laugh, you know, profiting from the drought. That you can't say that, you can't do that. So I went along to this one day course, expecting a laugh and anything. And I tell you what, it really sat me on my behind, because it made me think about what I was doing. You know, it made me think about, was I happy? It made me think about, you know, yeah, why? Why am I doing this? And luckily, a month later, this is an RCS one too, so you mentioned RCS before. It was life-changing. And then a month later, I went to a one-week course. I think over there you call it ranching for profit. Over here it's grazing for profit. And it was life-changing. And I don't say that lightly. It really made me stop. You know, I was just for years as a farmer, as a farmer's son and as a farmer, we just did it. You know, you just got in and you did what you always did, and we never rethought as much about it as we should have. But for that week, it totally blew my mind, because it made me stop and think and question, what were we actually doing with our landscape, with our money, with our time, you know, with our resources, with our cattle, you know, and what was the outcome? What was our soil really like? What was the quality of our pastures? And were we weren't even considering the landscape functions that Charlie Massey talks about, you know, the solar, the mineral, the water cycles and the biodiversity. We weren't even thinking about that. And what we definitely weren't thinking about is ourselves, you know, the people part of it, the most important principle, you know, because, look, I was having fun. I was young and I was a farmer boy, and I was just having a great old time, but I wasn't happy. And it was really this course that made me consider that. So, but that was a real change, a turning point for me. And then shortly after, I met my wife, and, you know, she had always been into organics long before it had been cool and trendy. You know, that was just what she was, you know. So, and then it was part of it being in the RCS system of network of farmers that we met Hamish McKay at a conference, and that's when biodynamics came into our our thinking and our practice on farm. So, you know, and I guess that was the sort of the time frames that are involved. But, you know, as I said, some of the turning points for me mentally, and Charlie Massey says it, you know, the first field you've got to change is the one between your ears, you know. So, yeah. And that's what doing the grazing for profit or ranching for profit did for me. And that's what biodynamics did for me. It really made me think about things so differently. So once I had those changes in my mind, and I guess some of those ones were, you know, loving my grass more than my cows, and it, you know, that was life changing. But the other one that was relates more to our paddock to plate, our you know, what we do is we value add our products. We just don't send our products, our cows and, you know, our steers and our lambs on a truck and send them to the markets. And once they leave our front gate, it's like, who cares? You know, we used to be commodity farmers. You know, we were talking in not quality. I mean, quality to some point. You want to, you know, this price is dependent on quality, but we were talking about quantity. You know, how much wheat, how many bales of wool, how many kilos of protein off a hectare. And that's fine, but the minute I started thinking about the fact that I'm actually growing food to feed people. People are eating the food and giving it to their children and putting it in their bodies. Well, that's a massive responsibility. So, you know, we the minute I changed from being, again, between my ears, from being a commodity farmer to a food grower, you know, that was everything. You know, decisions were much easier. Well, not easier, but they were. It was a different decision-making process. You know, is this good for the end customer? You know, no. Well, you know, we're not going to do that. You know, we can't put chemical all over these things as we used to do. You know, those sort of questions. Is it good for the landscape? No. You know, okay. Well, we've got to do things differently. So, I guess I hope that answers your question. There's some of the sort of, I guess, the transition events that occurred in my mind. And look, you know, I trust I have those every day. I hope that I'm learning from every mistake, and gee whiz, I've made some cracking good mistakes in my past, and I still am. So, you know, constantly growing, considering the people in our business. You know, I've just got a new farm manager on. He's fantastic. You know, the people in the business is really important, because that creates the vibe, it creates the atmosphere, the culture of a business. So. I'm sure you guys over there, you know, you definitely appreciate that as well. So, you know, get the people right, consider them, keep them happy. Not so much keep them happy, but they will be happy if you create the right environment, the right circumstances for that to happen. And that everything prospers, you know, that rule of abundance, and it really matters. So, yeah, I hope I've answered the question.
Absolutely. No, it was great. And I really appreciate your time today. I have no idea what time we actually started on the actual podcast. We talked for a bit before that. But I do just have one more question, and then we're done. I really appreciate your time today. That question being, you mentioned that you brought sheep back into the operation. Was part of the motivation of that the added benefit of multiple species grazing, or what was that about?
It was a bit of both. We used to have sheep, and we got rid of sheep when we started doing the sort of time control grazing and resting paddocks, because, you know, my view is, and that of many others, is the cattle are softer on the country. You know, they've got bigger mouths, they just can't do the damage, because there's a degree of difficulty or an error that, you know, if with time control grazing, where if they're there for too long, you know, they can do more damage, and sheep, if you leave them there too long, they can do a lot of damage. So I sort of removed them from the whole system. I said, look, I just want to keep it simple. So we went back to cattle. The reason for getting back into sheep was probably two. One was getting a different species in the landscape to do different things. And we had, you know, over those many years of not having sheep, fine-tuned what we're doing, and I consider what we do, you know, we do it pretty well. So we were ready, I guess, to have sheep back in the landscape, because we knew how to manage them. We're still putting up fences that we use single wire electric fences for cattle to contain sheep. We've got two or three wires, so we're still fencing, you know, literally as we speak, to sort of turn more country into sheep country, or be able to run sheep through there. But so we're better equipped to have sheep in the landscape. And the other thing was just as economically, you know, they give you options. You know, they're much shorter trade cycles. Wool here in Australia at the moment is worth, you know, what it was 10, 15 years ago again. You know, it's economically, it's a great thing to be growing. So that's why we've got them back in. And look, I love sheep. You know, a lot of people don't like sheep. I think they're just, it's the role they play is a, it's all about biodiversity, isn't it? You know, we've just having those different animals in the system makes a big difference. And, you know, we're all about as much flora and fauna as we can jam into our paddocks. And sheep have a role to play. So, you know, we're happy to have them running around.
Very good stuff, Charlie. I really appreciate your time today. Anything you want me to throw on the show notes page? Anything else that's been helpful or anything you want me to include there?
Look, you know, links to our stuff, I guess, Facebook and Instagram and those sort of things. My website would be wonderful, and I really appreciate that. I think we already talked about the biodynamic resources. Maria Thun, Thun, she also, for those who probably need a little more science behind biodynamics and sort of a bit more driven by data and results, she did some wonderful work in Europe with probably more vegetables and sort of that smaller scale stuff, and the use of biodynamics and also the planting calendar, the moon cycles and so on. So really interesting stuff there about how timing can really impact on production. And look, a lot of those things also translate to livestock production as well, when things are done in a month or in a year. So that's one that's probably worth adding and people looking up. Look, that's probably about it. I just encourage people to be open-minded about, you know, how they approach their landscape management and just, you know, Google this stuff. There's no excuse. There's so much of it out there now. And just try it, you know. And one thing that Hamish and I both suggest is if you're, you don't have to go cold turkey on this stuff. Not as though if you're you know, spending $500 a hectare on, whether you're, you know, in cropping or you're just, you know, running cattle or whatever, if you're having, you know, let's call them traditional inputs, conventional inputs, and it's X amount of money a hectare, just carve off 10% and put that into biodynamics. You don't have to sort of not use chemicals using biodynamics. Prefer not to. However, for people to ease into this sort of stuff, just, you know, slowly catch the monkey. Just do it slowly and build your confidence and then start adapting those practices and those recipes. And look, you'll have a lot of fun with this stuff. It's because, as I said, it connects you back with nature. You're using your own resources. You don't have to get on the phone to your chemical agent or your whoever you're buying stuff from and order stuff in. You literally step outside with a shovel and a bucket.
Yeah, good stuff, Charlie. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much,
Clay. It's been a pleasure. Really, I hope that's been useful, and all the best to your listeners. And I'll definitely be tuning in to subsequent to podcasts. So, Working Cows, I'll be spreading the good news and the love over here in Australia for you.
Cool. Yep. The tagline is providing producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm challenging practices. If it's the tagline, I should be able to spit it out. But anyways, and we've definitely done that here today. So thanks for your time.
Good on you. Thanks, Clay.
I was having supper the other night before the Corb Lund concert with a fellow High Plains Ranch Practicum alumni and listener of the Working Cows podcast, and he asked me what my favorite episode of the Working Cows podcast was, and I said, well, you know, the Brock Terrell episode comes to mind and some others, really paradigm-challenging ones, but I said, you know, this one that's coming out with Charlie Arnott was a really exciting one to me. Just really enjoyed that opportunity to sit down with Charlie and to talk to him a little bit more about what was going on in Australia, and I look forward to future opportunities to connect with people outside of the United States, outside of North America, and see what else is going on in the world of agriculture out there. So really looking forward to the opportunities presented by the Working Cows podcast. I will say this by way of closing out again, just a reminder to hit up workingcows.net /vote and vote once. I was confused earlier when I told you to vote every day. Just a reminder that you can vote once, and if you've already voted and you still want to support the show, go ahead and text that link to somebody who might be willing to go through the hoop of signing into their Facebook page and voting, or send that link out on your social media pages. Next week, we have Trenton Stout of Stout Seed. We're talking to him about no-till on the plains and some really interesting things that came away from there. So really encourage you to check that out. And we will be back next week with episode 77 of the Working Cows podcast with Trenton Stout.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.